KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My name is Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit. We'll be back in just a few minutes. KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Welcome to the radio program, everybody. My name is Mike Hagan. Good evening to you, or good morning to you. Good day, whoever you might be, wherever you might be. Welcome to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Good to be here with you all tonight. I'm very happy to be back here in Columbia and back on the radio station with you all tonight and excited about the show. But first, a quick thank you to Corey. As always, New Wave Radio Theater. 1 hour before this program, 10 p.m. every Monday night, New Wave Radio Theater with Corey. I came in the middle of the program. I think tonight she did Huck Finn. But at any rate, great stuff always and interesting. Never know what Corey's going to have on for you. So next week, come on back and listen to New Wave Radio Theater. 1 hour before this program, 10 p.m. every Monday night. Before that, Kelvin and Eric, Do It Up. Jazz plus blues equals spring fever. Tech Radio at 6 p.m. Keeping us up on the ridiculous world of high technology. Jeff Wheeler starts things off with Uncommon Light. 3 to 5 p.m. every Monday. Good music, good talk, good news. A rainy Monday night. Warm, though. Moon waning, about a quarter full. Nice night to chill out with Radio Orbit, okay? 31st of March. And you're listening to it here, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM, your imagination station. Glad to be here with y'all and a part of it. You know, if you were listening last week, I was away. I took a much-needed vacation to Colorado. Had a really nice time and got to see some old friends and some very close friends, as a matter of fact. And I got to get up into the mountains and I got to see my four-and-a-half-year-old son learn how to ski. That was a pleasure and a thrill, actually, for me. And had a few cocktails and just really enjoyed myself with some friends and family out there in Colorado. So it was a thrill to be out there and a pleasure to be back. So I didn't hear the show last week, nor did I do the show. So it's the first time in quite some time, actually, that I've taken a Monday off. But a big thank you to Kyle Cook, who stepped in and kept you company last week, or at least I'm assuming he did. I've yet to hear what Kyle and company did, but I'm certain it was a switch from the norm. So thanks, Kyle. You're awesome. And if you think that name is familiar, maybe you've heard Kyle on his radio program. He does a show with his partner, Tony, called Mystery Science Radio 3000, which is on KOPN Saturday nights, early Sunday morning, 2 a.m. to 5 a.m., as a matter of fact, on Sunday mornings. Kyle and Tony have an amazing and interesting and fun and always unpredictable radio program late Saturday nights after bar time. MSR 3000, check it out. And once again, thanks, Kyle, and whoever else was around here to do the program last week, okay? By the way, if you missed last week's show, like I did, you'll have to wait a few more days for me to get it up in there into the archives. Any of the other past shows, however, you can always hear them after the fact. They're all on the web on my website, www.mikehagan.com, in the program archives. All right, take a look around in there. Maybe you'll hear something you like. If you do, share it with someone else if you get the notion, okay? Okay, tonight, just you and me and our good friend Terrence McKenna. Terrence passed over to the realm of the ancestors 8 years ago this coming Thursday. That's the 3rd of April. And I wanted to do something special for T and the anniversary of his departure. Tonight we'll hear a piece called Understanding and Imagination in the Light of Nature. It was recorded in Los Angeles, California in October of 1987, I think. Maybe 88. Anyway, L.A., late 80s, and Terrence McKenna. We'll do space weather and a few other things during this first hour, and we'll hear some music from the Tragically Hip. We started the show off with a song called Grace 2. The band, the Tragically Hip, they're one of my favorite, maybe my favorite band. They may be my favorite sort of all-time band. And well, there's a good reason, because they've just got a tremendous number of just absolutely amazing songs. And so we will hear another one of those amazing songs right now, okay? Let's do that. We will play a tune here and give me a chance to get things organized here in the studio. and then we'll come back and do it up. Terrence McKenna, a little bit later, Understanding and Intelligence in the Light of Nature. Wonderful piece of material recorded in L.A. in the late 80s, okay? In the meanwhile, here is a song from, let's see, from The Tragically Hip. I'm trying to think. This is just a wonderful tune. All right, this is called Fiddler's Green. And it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM, Radio Orbit, back in just a few. Fiddler's Green, that's The Tragically Hip. You listen to it on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My name is Mike Hagan. This is Radio Orbit. So yeah, the Tragically Hip, I sort of made an exception tonight with regard to music. They're not particularly independent. They are a band that is sort of a major label from Canada, but a very independent thinking band. So I decided that I would do it because they're just, as I said earlier, one of my favorite bands and a group of musicians that have been putting out great music for a long, long time. And I've sort of alluded to them a little bit in the past, earlier in the life of this program, before I really committed to independent music. I would play lots of different stuff and mix it up during the program. And I played a lot of Tragically Hip during the first year or so of the program, but haven't for a real long time. And tonight I decided I'd sort of feature them for the whole program because it is some of my favorite stuff. And even though they're pretty well known up there north of the border, there's still quite a few down here in the U.S. and I'm sure other places around the world that aren't familiar yet with the Tragically Hip. So tonight, the introduction for those of you, okay? All right, hello to everybody listening to us this evening on KOPN over the traditional airwaves or over the Internet, live or otherwise. I do this every Monday night, broadcast the show from the beautiful studios of KOPN Columbia, which is, of course, in lovely downtown Columbia, Missouri. And we stream the show live as well on the web, kopn.org. Just click on the Listen Live button, and you'll be able to hear the program or any other program broadcast on KOPN here over the Internet, anywhere where you've got a decent connection, okay? Thanks to everybody who makes it happen here at KOPN and for the people that help me in my own sort of ventures. And with regard to the Internet, certainly that's Larry Noriger, the web wizard. A big thank you to Larry. Thanks as well to all the other people out there that are participating on the website, sharing their thoughts and ideas and interests on the forum and in the chat room. Thanks to all the people who are sending art, you know, their music, their poetry, their painting, all that stuff. I appreciate it so much. And if you're an artist of any variety, get in touch with me and we'll figure out a way to share your art. Find a place for it on the website and make it available for other people to see, okay? If you're interested in checking out what I'm talking about, take a look over there yourself, all right? Let me know what you think. Just click your mouse over to Mike Hagan, HAGAN.com. You'll have access to everything that we're doing over there. And please share your thoughts. Let me know what you think. It is worthy and paid attention to, okay? If you're interested in participating with other listeners of the program, there is a forum that is always busy and interesting topics being discussed over there quite often. Lots more than I can keep up with, but I try to get in and throw my two cents in when I get a chance. There's a live chat that's up and active tonight, as always, during the program, but available 24/7. Thanks, as always, to Chaos for his efforts in putting that whole thing together. I so appreciate the work that he's done. It's so cool. Every Monday night, we got this great chat room and a whole community of people that come and go from that cyber community, and it's a blast. And I imagine that the chat from last week with Kyle and that gang must be pretty funny. I'll have to go over there and take a look at it if it's up there on the posted on the forum, as I imagine that it is. At any rate, it's awesome, and I thank you all so much for being a part of it, okay? All right, we'll peek into the chat room, as a matter of fact, for questions, comments throughout the program tonight. I encourage my guests as well as listeners to join us over there. It's a great way to get to know other people that are sort of on the same plane as you, perhaps, all right? Okay, my email address, orbitradio, O-R-B-I-T-R-A-D-I-O, orbitradio, at AOL.com. Send email to me. Send email to the guests that are on the program. And that sort of excludes the guest tonight because he probably won't respond. But the musicians that are on the program may. Also, my website, once again, www.mikehagan.com. Phone number here in the studio, 573-874-5676. That's if you'd like to call during a break or something and just say hi. If you'd like to get on the air, and we may take some phone calls during the last hour of the program tonight, the phone number, 573-443-8255. That's 573-443-TALK, if you'd like to call and get on the air later in the program when we open the phone lines, okay? All right, upcoming guests tonight, yours truly, with a retro appearance from Terrence McKenna. Next week, Nikki Scully She's a very interesting young woman that is writing and talking about shamanism and visiting all kinds of interesting spots around the world that are involved with similar ideas. So we'll talk with Nikki Scully next week on the 7th of April. The following week on the 14th, I'm hoping to have Kent back on the air with us. Kent Stedman, my great friend and mentor, and just the most wonderful person. Kent has been on the program many, many times before, and he's been sort of under the weather for, well, quite some time, and feeling much better now, though, and I think it's time to get him back on the air. So even though he doesn't know it, I think we'll be doing a program on the 14th of April with Kent Stedman. cyberspaceorbit.com, and I'll talk a little bit more about Kent's website during this first hour because there's some amazing stuff up there at his site. On the 21st of April, we have an open date. I'm not sure what's going to fall in there. On the 28th of April, we have Dr. Neil Goldsmith, Richard Allen Miller. Rick Miller back with us live on the 6th of May. He'll be here in the studio with me, actually going to be doing some stuff here in Columbia, and you know, it's a month and a week or so from then, so any of you listeners out there that have the gumption and the means and the will to come out and join us, that might be a good weekend to take a little trip out here to Columbia, Missouri, because Richard Allen Miller will be here for a couple of days on Monday and Tuesday, the 6th and 7th of May, and he'll be doing a program with me here at KOPN, as we always do on Monday night, and then he'll be presenting some of his own material on Tuesday. And I think we'll be talking about sustainable agriculture, personal farming, you know, small acreage farming, and how people can, you know, do a better job of taking care of themselves and their family and their friends and their community, perhaps. So anyway, that should be really fun to have Rick Miller here with us in Columbia for a few days, the 6th and the 7th of May. Richard Allen Miller, okay? All right, David Abram, a little bit later this summer, hopefully, still trying to work that out. And, you know, I'm trying to talk, a lot of people are telling me, please, Mike, talk with somebody about alternative energy and hydrogen and all the new breakthroughs in, you know, sustainable alternative energy. And I'd be glad to do that. I'm trying to come up with a good, suitable guest for that particular topic. And, you know, I'm looking, you guys know me. I mean, I'm not looking for the, for parlor tricks or the same old, you know, same old stuff. I'm looking for people or a person who either has or knows about a paradigm shifting technology. All right. I mean, over the top stuff, but I want evidence. And it's got to have some sort of a working prototype or something like that. You got to be able to know that the thing works, and, you know, it should just blow the minds of everybody. There should be no doubt about it. There should be no debate. That's what I'm looking for. So if anybody knows of people or persons who, you know, sort of meet those qualifications and can prove it, well, I'd be glad to talk with them, all right? All right, Graham Hancock as well later this year for those who've been asking, all right? Many others in the wing, and I look forward to doing it all. So, we will. It is already one-fourth of the way through the year of 2008. Can you believe how the time is flying by? It's just amazing. But as Terrence McKenna said many, many years ago, time is speeding up, and synchronicity is increasing, and novelty is on the rise, and habit is on the way out, and all these things are actually really happening. We're starting to be able to witness it in our own worlds. In my case, I mean, to a level that's excruciating, and I'm fascinated and freaked out and excited, and absolutely privileged to feel a part of this whole thing in the middle of it. And I think, I hope that you guys do too. All right, it's Mike, and it's Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. This is The Tragically Hip, and the song is called So Hard Done By.
sophisticated, refusing to be celebrated. It's a monumental big screen kiss. It's so deep, it's meaningless. One day you'll just up and quit, and that'll be it. Just in a stripper stopped in a coffin fit. She said, sorry, I can't go on with this. Yeah, that's awful close, but that's not why. I'm so hard done by. It was true cinema eclair. You should see it before there's nothing left. In an epic too smart to be tragic, you'll have to wait a minute, cause it's an instamatic. Yeah, that's awful close, but that's not why. I'm so hard done by. Just then the room became more dimly lit as the MC carried on with it. And now that I got you all strangely compelled, I'm afraid Candy's not feeling well. Oh, that's not why. So hard to
once again, the Tragically Hip. That one's called So Hard Done By, from a CD called Day for Night. Great, great stuff from the Tragically Hip. Music from Toronto, Canada. And believe it or not, I don't know what the website is, but I imagine it's thetragicallyhip.com. All right, it's Mike, and you're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia. By the way, KOPN is on the web at kopn.org. And I'd like to say hello to all the listeners out there. And I want to make a quick thank you to those of you who have donated money and become members here at KOPN of the radio station. A number of people over the, you know, we had the pledge drive a month or two ago, but between the pledge drive and now, there have been a number of people that have just sort of been trickling in, you know, one or two a week or something like that, who listen to the program and who are typically not from the Missouri area, people that listen over the internet. And so for those of you who have donated to the radio station and to the cause here at KOPN, I sure appreciate it, and I want to let you know that it does get noticed and it does make a difference. We have a very tight budget here, and if you came down here to see it yourself, you would know what I'm talking about, but there's very little money wasted around here, and anything that is donated by listeners is appreciated and put to good use. So to all of you who, and now you're members of the station, and you know, you can participate in voting of the board of directors. You can you know, write a letter to the station manager. You can do whatever you want, and you can bet that you'll be responded to. So anyway, I appreciate the support. Thank you very much to all of you out there. And to my friend Chris, who just came in. The studio is going to be hanging out for a little while. Hello to Chris. Haven't seen him for a while. Good friend. And everybody else out there who's around, okay? All right, it is about 27 minutes or so before the midnight hour on the 31st of March, soon to be the 1st of April, and we're moving right through the year 2008, all right? Let's talk a little bit about space weather, but before that, I'm going to sort of do a little scroll down of Ken Stedman's site right now, and space weather will certainly come up as I do that, but at the top of his site right now is one of the most amazing things that you'll see. Of course, there are a lot of amazing things going on these days, but this is certainly one of them, and there is a video that Ken has posted up on the top of his site. It's a YouTube vid from India, I believe, but anyway, it is an elephant that is a painter, and y'all know I like art, and I'll tell you what, man, some of y'all are going to be scooped by this four-legged, brilliant painter from the other side of the planet, and this is really amazing. I'm not kidding. It's sort of a see-it-to-believe-it sort of thing, but what this elephant does is paint a beautiful self-portrait, and it takes about 7 or 8 minutes to watch the entire video, but after the first couple minutes, you'll be hooked enough to watch the whole thing. I mean, it's absolutely remarkable, and it's not impressionistic, if you know what I mean. I mean, the elephant actually walks into the frame of the camera carrying a bucket with paints and paint brushes in it. And he's accompanied, or she, I'm not sure if it's a male or a female elephant, but the elephant is accompanied by a man. The elephant is not bound in any way. It's not chained or doesn't appear to be leashed or anything like that. So I'm not sure, and I don't know the background of this story. I don't know if it's a wild elephant or if it's one that is, you know, hangs out with these folks. But at any rate, the elephant chooses a brush and gets, you know, puts paint on the brush, typically the way, you know, any painter would. And the way that the elephant picks up the brush is with its trunk, and it holds a regular paintbrush. It's just a regular paintbrush, and it begins to draw on the canvas. And at first, you know, like many artists, it's really interesting actually to watch art, visual art, painted art, be created, because as an observer, what you do is you watch it, and depending on how close you're observing, or depending on the nature of your own consciousness, you may or may not, you know, after a certain amount of time, be able to figure out what the artist is actually doing. And, you know, if you're watching somebody like Picasso, then you know, boy, it's a challenge. But for an artist that paints more objective material, well, after a certain amount of time and number of lines drawn and strokes made, you can start to make out what the painter is actually doing. Well, this is exactly what happens with this elephant. About 2 or 3 minutes into the painting, you start to see the image very clearly of an elephant, of itself. And at first you think, oh, all right, well, yeah, it's obvious that that's an elephant, but it's not that good. I mean, the fact that it's happening to begin with sort of escapes you, because you recognize that there's actually a painter at work, and now you start to judge the quality of the painting, you know, and sort of forget about the actual painter. But the elephant, after drawing a two-dimensional version of itself, adds the third and the fourth leg, and you realize that the elephant understands perspective and three-dimensionality. And it goes on for quite some time, for a few more minutes, and then eventually It begins with black, just with black paint on a white canvas. And the last stroke of genius that the elephant adds is in the painting that the elephant is doing of itself or of another elephant, it has its trunk extended up toward the sky. And the last thing that it does is it paints a flower in its own trunk. And the only part of the picture that has any color is the flower that the elephant holds up in his or her trunk. It's just an amazing thing to watch, and I'm trying to load it up on my own computer here now with Chris as we're talking about it, because I was hoping to describe the entire sort of thing, but I think Kent maybe only has up the first portion of the video, but it's remarkable. And if you'd like to check it out, I encourage you to go to cyberspaceorbit.com and just look right there at the top of Kent's page. Or if you go to YouTube, you can probably just do elephant art or something like that, and I'm sure you'll be able to find it. But this is a remarkable thing, and it's another example of obvious intelligence in nature, where we, you know, more often than not, assume there is little or no intelligence. This painting that this elephant does, I'm telling you, it's absolutely remarkable. If you don't go look at it, you won't appreciate what I'm saying. It's one of these things, you have to see it to believe it. But it is absolutely stunning, and you know, better than I could do, for sure. Kent Stedman, whose website, you know, we're talking about here, and who has this this video posted, he's an amazing artist himself. And Ken put a post up on my forum and said, you know, I've been trumped by an elephant. How worthwhile I think this thing is of for you to watch, all right? So anyway, go to YouTube or go to cyberspaceorbit.com and check out this elephant doing self-portrait of his or herself. And there's a number of related films. There's a whole bunch of films of this elephant. So anyway, you might go check it out. It's pretty cool. All right, I'm trying to get back on the website here, because there's a bunch of good stuff on Kent's site right now, and I want to make sure that that we cover all of it. All right, space weather, which I would normally do right now, I will, because there are some amazing things that are happening up there in the sky. There was a gamma ray burst that occurred, I think, on the 21st or the 22nd of March, and it is the most powerful gamma ray burst that, well, I should rephrase. It is the brightest gamma ray burst that has ever been visible in modern times to the naked eye. And this is an amazing thing. The star exploded halfway across the universe, and it was visible to the naked eye, to, you know, to an observer here on Earth without a telescope. You could see it here. Now, that is an amazing thing. Listen to this from, this is actually on CNN. God, go figure. Hard to believe it. From Washington, the AP. The explosion of a star halfway across the universe. Now the first line of the story, because it's in the mainstream, I have to pick on it, right? The first line of the story says, the explosion of a star halfway across the universe was so huge, it set a record for the most distant object that could be seen on Earth by the naked eye. Now, nobody knows what halfway across the universe is, all right? So they're just groping for what the hell is happening. Nobody knows what the hell is happening. And it's actually really one of the coolest things, because science sort of shot itself in the foot. Scientism, I should say. Science is alive and well. Scientism shot itself in the foot because of its own ambition. And it developed tools that opened the door to the unimaginable. And the tools of the scientists began to reveal things that the scientists themselves couldn't understand, and to this day have no understanding of. The gamma ray burst is a wonderful example of this. There's still a tremendous amount of debate among astrophysicists about what a gamma ray burst even is. I mean, the jury is still way out on what the hell is happening with these things. Nobody knows what's going on. I sent an email to Dr. Paul LaViolette with regard to this one, asking Paul, you know, his opinion on this. And he certainly has credible and qualified of an opinion out there in the astrophysical community as you can get, in my opinion. And, you know, we'll see what Dr. Paul has to say about it. But the story here in CNN is, as usual, you know, just short and sweet with, you know, sort of the little bits of fun stuff, you know, for the masses or whatever. But it doesn't get close to explaining what's happening here. And the reason it doesn't is because nobody knows. And this is something that you don't hear often enough from science, you know, and from the scientists. It's funny, somebody asked me a couple of weeks ago how I choose guests for the program, you know, who I decide that I'll invite to be on Radio Orbit, and why there are some people who I don't invite to the program, people who maybe others might think, you know, would be welcome here. And I thought about it a little bit, and I have, I guess, a lot of criteria, but two of the primary ones are these. The first one is they have to be very comfortable saying the words, I don't know. They have to be comfortable saying that they don't know about something. Because otherwise, you know, it becomes obvious that they're very tied to their own ideas. And probably not very willing to look at or accept new ideas. And the other thing that I look for, or one of the other things that's very important for me when I look for guests, is do they respect their ancestors? Do they give credit to all of those who came before them and whose shoulders upon which they stand and whose work upon which they build? And so those two things are sort of the primary things. People who are willing to be humble enough to recognize when they don't know something. And second of all, you know, people who respect and honor those who came before them. And, you know, anybody who's doing interesting work that satisfies those two criteria, you know, I'd consider having on the program. You'd be surprised how few there are. You know? And I say that, you know, without hesitation. Most people, frankly, are out there hawking something. They're trying to sell a book or trying to... Look, I understand people have to make a living, all right? And I appreciate it, okay? The thing is where the intention lies, you know? Money will come. If you do good art and if you do good work and if you're telling good stories, you know, you'll get your money. You'll get enough. You'll get enough to get by. You know, you may not be Hugh Hefner or whatever, but the grandfathers will take care of you. You know, the grandmothers will take care of you. You will be taken care of. But nature loves courage, though. You know, nature loves courage. And so you have to be able to, you know, to do things that a lot of people probably aren't willing to do. And so I've got no problem if people are writing a book or if they're promoting their website or if they're trying to do a speaking, you know, engagement somewhere and try to make a few dollars. I understand it's the nature of the world that we live in. We have to have money to survive. I have to make money, of course, like all of you, you know. If you're not independently wealthy and, you know, inherited some great fortune from your great uncle William, well, you know, the rest of us have to work. And I do the same thing. The difference is I don't work for the radio gig. You know, the radio thing I do is independent of my work. So it's one of the reasons why I can do what I do on the radio, because it's not the way I make my living, you know. And there's no way that I could. In the current cultural, social environment, there's no way a radio host like me is actually going to get a gig at a paying station to do what I do, because the nature of consumer corporate capitalism has no interest whatsoever in airing the views that are aired on my program, not to mention my own. I mean, you know, it's just there's just no room for it in that particular paradigm. It's frightening to them, and it's abhorrent and obscene in many people's opinion. It's very, you'd be surprised the people that think I'm just obscene. I mean, to think that the things that I'm talking about and the things that I allow to be discussed on this radio program are about as bad as you could get. In fact, tonight, in just a few minutes, we'll be playing a piece from Terrence McKenna. And I guarantee you that I'll hear, you know, hell's bells, you know, from a certain contingent out there because of the views and the ideas and the information that's being shared on this program. So it's the only way that I can do it is to do it for free. This is the only and this is why KOPN is such a treasure and such a beacon, because, you know, Cumulus or Clear Channel or whoever don't pull the strings over here, and we still have the ability, you know, to do real free speech radio, which is what this is. You know, nobody tells me what I put on my radio program except my grandfathers. That's who I listen to more than anyone, you know. And so far, you know, even though I do get a little bit of grief here and there, the radio program rolls along, and I still do it, and I'm still here, and the ideas of Terrence McKenna and many of the other people that appear on this program are still around too, and they're not going to go away, and I'm not going to go away. So, anyway, all that from a star that exploded halfway across the universe. Gamma ray bursts. You know, a couple of weeks ago, there were 5 gamma ray bursts in one day. It was the most that had ever been recorded. Now, there may be more happening. It's just that's what our instruments were able to record. You know, we don't have access to all information in the universe everywhere. Who knows what the hell is happening up there? This is the whole point of this stuff. You know, the whole point is to show how little we know about this universe. My God, we get stories every week about things that are happening on our own planet that nobody knew about. And yet, you know, we oftentimes buy into essentially propaganda that causes many people to believe that we actually have, you know, the secrets of the universe in our back pocket, and that we actually know everything about everything, when it turns out we actually know very little about very little. So, anyway, cyberspaceorbit.com is a place where you can learn a little about a lot. And if you just scroll down Kent's page right now, my God, just an amazing bit of work that he's been doing for the last week or so. You know, it's obvious to me that Kent is feeling better, because the website was slow for a bit of the time there when Kent was in the hospital and going through some very difficult times. But my God, he is back at it now, and at it with a vengeance. Here's a story about the Large Hadron Collider. This is that super collider in Switzerland. It's an atom smasher, you know, particle accelerator at CERN. I think it's called the Large Hadron Super Collider. Anyway, this is an experiment that has been postponed and delayed and talked about for some time now, for a number of years, and with some in the scientific world actually even being concerned about what they were trying to do here. There's actually a lawsuit now that's been filed by a group that is trying to stop the work at the Large Hadron Collider before they actually undergo this experiment that's supposed to happen very soon. And the basis of the lawsuit is that the scientists themselves have admitted that they believe that there's a... And the way they say it is really funny, actually. They say there's not a zero chance, not a zero likelihood, or not a zero chance that the experiment that to be conducted at the Large Hadron Collider at CERN would open up a black hole on planet Earth and essentially do what black holes do, you know, pretty much take care of the whole local environment. So it would be the end of life on Earth as we know it. And the scientists have said that there's not a zero chance of that happening. Now, I'm not sure how close to 100% of it is, probably not very, but anyway, the fact that they even concede that is actually very funny to me. I'm really not concerned about the Large Hadron Collider destroying planet Earth and the local solar system and galactic neighborhood, but I think it's interesting that that people are concerned about it. And I think that the whole particle physics thing is just another one of these, you know, it's just sort of a shell game. And I'm very unimpressed by particle physics and atom smashing and all this stuff. I don't think they've done much good for anybody. And I really don't think they've really known much about anything, frankly. I mean, you can put names on minuscule particles all day. You know, you can have a neutrino and then a who knows what, you know, all these different names of particles that we have over the years. You know, it started with, you know, the smallest thing was the cell, and then the molecule, you know, and then the atom, and then we learned about DNA and smaller bits of matter, and then, you know, of course you have the makeup of the atom, the nucleus, and the proton and the neutron and the electron. But then that wasn't enough either. After that, then you get the smaller ones, the subatomic particles, you know. And that's when it gets really interesting, the quarks and the muons and the, you know, they even start to borrow names from Star Trek, you know, and this sort of stuff. So the interesting thing is that it has no bearing on anybody's life whatsoever. What's a muon mean to you in your daily life, Chris? Does it mean anything to you? I mean, the fact that people put names on things that nobody can see or nobody can prove exist outside of some small priesthood of electron microscopy experts or something, I mean, it's just, it becomes ridiculous, actually, pretty quickly. But, you know, they can smash them up there in Switzerland as hard as they like, I guess. And I'm sure they'll tell you that they came up with another wonderful new particle that means nothing to no one. And that's the way that they'll, you know, justify the next $500 billion they get to waste, you know, some more people's time. So, anyway, that's sort of what I think about that. But, you know, go for it, you know. Anyway, okay, stars exploding halfway across the universe and silly scientists on planet Earth trying to explode stars right here as well. All right, what else is on Kent Stedman's website? The web is actually slow for me right now, so I actually look at the clock, and that's a sign that says, take a break, play a piece of music, and come back with your brother, Terrence Kemp McKenna. We will do it, okay? In the meanwhile, what will I play? The Tragically Hip. Well, man, it's a difficult choice. But in honor of Terrence, I think that I'll play a song that's called Escape Is at Hand for the Traveling Man. It's Mike, you're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN, Columbia, 89.5 FM, back in 5 minutes with Terrence McKenna.
Yeah.
Escape is at hand for the traveling man, and I'm going to offer you all an escape route here at 5 minutes after 12 a.m. now, I guess, early in the morning on the 1st of April. Ha! April Fools, as it were, huh? All right, so you all got a heads up, right? Don't be fooled today or tomorrow, because, you know, someone out there will try to play a trick on you or something. Well, I'm not playing any tricks tonight. I'm actually going to give you something that you can maybe... Well, this might trick you, actually. Hopefully it does. It's Mike, and it's Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, right now. Terrence Kemp McKenna from 1987, Los Angeles, California, Understanding and Intelligence in the Light of Nature.
Can you all hear me? Can you hear in the back? Yeah? Not very well? Make them hear in the back. Okay. That's much better, isn't it? Is it better in the back? Good, good. Well, I would like to... join with Roy in thanking all of the people who made this possible. Mary Fowler worked long and hard to make this happen. Eric Ali did the wonderful graphics for the poster. Pam here has controlled and managed traffic flow here this evening. Diane and Roy are incomparable treasures in the LA community. I was talking to someone today who said they had listened to KPFK very carefully in the month that Roy and Diane were away, and it just ain't the same thing. It's terrifying to think that two human beings in a city of, what, 11 million are what's holding up the hip. The hip end of things. As Roy said, this is a benefit for KPFK and in a larger sense for Botanical Dimensions. Botanical Dimensions is the nonprofit that Kat and I and Rupert Sheldrake and Ralph Metzner, Ralph Abraham, Frank Barr, a number of people have organized to carry out plant rescue operations for medicinal plants and plants with a history of shamanic usage. And we have a botanical farm in Hawaii, 20 acres, maintain collectors in South America, and occasionally support collecting in Africa. And this is our real world political work beyond the communicating and the publishing and that sort of thing, where we actually try to impact some of the negative so-called progressive changes that are taking place in the third world and disrupting rainforest culture and causing this shamanic and folk pharmacopoeia to be lost. So I appreciate your being here tonight in support of that. It's very important work, far more expensive than I thought it was when we organized the foundation, and it's ongoing, so we never really seem to be ahead. So I want to thank you for your support of that. In line with that, I've been living with Kat and our two children in Hawaii on the Big Island for the past year, and not really doing any public speaking because there was none to be done there. And it was a very good opportunity to get out from under the electronic umbrella of the sprawl of North American culture and to sort of look at it and assess it as this practice of speaking with groups of people has become more and more a part of my life. It has sort of changed in my mind from the addressing of certain topics and the building of a talk around a theme to more just pointing and looking and saying, well, here we are, here's where we've arrived tonight. What is the situation? What is the state of the world? What is the state of the union? I think psychedelics had a very large impact, I'm sure there's no argument on this, in the 1960s. But in a way, it was not ever anchored in anything. It was never explained to anybody, by anybody, how it fit into the historical context of what had preceded it. Perhaps because no one actually knew at that time. For instance, there was no the invoking of shamanism as an explanation for how plant hallucinogens work on psyche is completely alien to the literature of the 1960s. It just isn't there. And speaking of aliens, the theme of alien intelligence or of hyperdimensional organized intellects contacted in the psychedelic state, that also was an absent theme. It was basically presented, the psychedelic experience was basically presented as an exploration of the contents of the personality with a little bit of overflow into aesthetic issues. So I remember in the early days we would stack our Abrams books on Hieronymus Bosch and Piero della De Francesca and Giotto, and then the idea following Aldous Huxley was that you would imbibe the meaning of these great works of art behind the kind of psychic freedom that the psychedelic substance was going to graft on to your ordinary consciousness. Well, I think all those kinds of metaphors were useful, but it's been now 20, 25 years of looking at that phenomenon and also of having the future continue to overtake us with ever more demands upon our cultural resourcefulness and our ability to cognize the cultural situation. And I think now it can be seen somewhat differently. And so these two nights in Los Angeles, which are called Understanding and Imagination in the Light of Nature, are a kind of effort to take several telescoping steps backward and place the adventure of psychedelic self-exploration in context, to frame it in a number of different ways, because I think it's very important for us to know, as the Hermetic mysteries urge us to know, whither we have come, where we are, who we are, and whence we are going. All issues that the psychedelic experience, especially to my mind the plant hallucinogens, bring into close focus. Here is an opportunity for a theater of cultural growth that is unparalleled. How did we find ourselves in this situation? What is exactly the nature of the cultural situation in which then the psychedelic response is called forth as part of a spectrum of cultural responses? Basically, what's been going on in Western civilization for about 500 years is the exploration of the metaphor of materialism, which began as a simple limiting case. Since we're at the Philosophical Research Society, it behooves us to talk philosophy for a moment and remind you that there is what's called Occam's razor. William of Ockham was a late medieval philosopher, and his razor was that hypotheses should not be multiplied without necessity. Without necessity. In other words, the simplest explanation should be preferred in all cases. The fewest number of elements should be put forward as necessary for an explanation. And following William of Ockham's statement of this notion as a logical way of proceeding, the assumption was made then, a provisional assumption at the beginning, that matter could be separated from the notion of soul and spirit, that it could be divided into its simplest units, and out of the activity of those simple units, a model could be built up that would explain more complex phenomena in the world, Cartesian materialism, which was applied very successfully to physical matter, to the chemical elements. And so successfully, in fact, that the provisional nature of the assumption was soon forgotten in the explanatory zeal of the people who had latched onto this method. And so it was then applied out of the chemical realm, but moved into the biological realm. And the search was on for the biologically irreducible units, which in the 17th century was the cell, and great excitement about the cell. And then in the 20th century, of course, first the nucleus of the cell, then ultimately DNA as the constituent of the nucleus, which was controlling protein synthesis. But strangely enough, the elucidation of the mechanics of the gene through this program of reductionism did not issue into the same kind of control over the products of the gene that the same program had, the same kind of fruit that had been born in the analysis of physical matter. And in the early years of this century, when the effort was made to extend the metaphor into psychology, the true inadequacy of it became clearly seen, so that the effort to break the personality down into types or complexes or archetypes or behavioral strategies all failed. And at the same time that this process of disconfirmation was happening in the social sciences, physics, which had been old reliable in the matter of supporting this particulate, pointillistic, materialistic school of explanation, began in fact to betray it, because the analysis of matter was pushed to deeper and deeper levels until finally phenomena began to be elucidated which seemed incomprehensible in the mechanical model. It seemed as though what had been thought of as points of matter were in fact spread through time, and the notion of simple location began to give way to talk of clouds of probability and this sort of thing. All of this reaching a culmination in 1923 with the Copenhagen Conference on Quantum Physics, where basically a new vision of matter was elucidated. And strangely enough, the new view of matter seemed to have a very mentalist sort of aura about it. It no longer was a theory of simple location, calculable energies, and specific predictions. It was probabilistic. Now, this reemergence of the need for a wave mechanical description of matter can, I think, now be seen from the vantage point of 55 years as the first stirrings, or among the first stirrings, of the reemergence of the spirit. And I think that what understanding and imagination in the light of nature argues for is the presence and reemergence of the awareness of spirit in the world. This is what the so-called and long-heralded paradigm shift is all about. It is a vast turning over of the intellectual universe, which will eclipse many idea systems and support many more. It is the idea of fields. Spirit need not be defined or even conceived in any sort of 19th century or mentalist or animist way. What spirit is a field of deployed energy that is somehow co-present at more than one point in space and time. It is the shadow that haunts the particularized world of Newtonian matter. And it is, strangely enough, the commonest object of experience. In other words, as we move through our lives, as we project our hopes, as we plan our days, as we execute our jobs, we move in this realm of spirit. The problem is that we have been very slowly but very efficiently corralled inside an intellectual system which gives no credence to spirit, and therefore has had a curious effect on the validation that we give our own lives. For instance, if you look at positivist philosophy, which is the dominant philosophical paradigm in academic philosophy, there you learn that there are primary and secondary qualities to the world. And the primary qualities are charge, spin, angular momentum, velocity, this sort of thing. Things which nowhere come tangential to the felt world of the individual. Well, then there are also so-called secondary qualities. Color, taste, tone, feeling. All the things that make up the world that you and I experience. So somehow we are not traveling in first class on this metaphysical airliner. You know, we're back there with the secondary qualities. And the good stuff is all up front, and it is described and manipulated by incomprehensible equations. You have to enter into a priesthood to become part of it. Well, it's to our credit, I think, that we are waking up. And one of the reasons that we are waking up is because into the objects of common experience, by an exhaustive search of the objects of common experience, diligent, clear-thinking seekers after understanding people who are practicing, who took seriously the Constitution's assurance of the pursuit of happiness, have Robert Bork notwithstanding, have found more than the right of privacy in the Constitution, but have actually found the right to alter your own consciousness for purposes of personal growth. Well, consciousness is like a still pool. If it is unperturbed, it returns a clear image of the world, in the same way that the unperturbed surface of a pond will become a mirror to the environment around it. But if consciousness is perturbed by being shifted from its ordinary modalities, then and the extraordinarily tenuous and provisional nature of what we call reality swims into our ken. And we see, you know, that what we take to be solid objects, what we take to be here and now, what we take to be personal identity versus other in the form of other personalities, that all of these things hang by the most tenuous of linguistic threads and cultural conventions, and that beneath the surface of those conventions is utter terra incognito, a no man's land, the unexplored territory behind cultural assumptions. Suddenly, starkly, totally incontrovertibly illuminated to the inspection of the individual. Well, this is feeding. Indeed, to my mind, it is the major factor responsible for the reemergence of the awareness of the spirit. It holds out the possibility that we can create a new definition of our own humanness, that it was fine for purposes of disentangling from the medieval church to take the materialist route and to follow it into Darwinian evolution, to recognize our ascent from previous primate forms, and to sort of claim a dimension of existential freedom. But that is not the whole story. That essentially is the legacy or the achievement of modernism, which was fully worked out by 1927 or 8, I would say. I mean, those people, the pataphysicians, the quantum physicists, the Dadaists, the surrealists, Alfred Jarry, André Breton, it was all worked out. And those of us who were born after that time and have come into this sort of pseudo-eschaton of regurgitation of modern values in art, fashion, and literature have been living in this kind of a goldfish bowl ever since. I mean, really, it's astonishing the degree to which, in the most progressive and fast-moving century in the last 10 or 20, for that matter, there has also been an extraordinary backward current, a very strong recidivism that has held at bay the true exfoliation of what modernity was supposed to mean. That's why within the 20th century, the further back you go, the more utopian the projection of the future becomes, and the further into the 20th century you go, the more like a dystopia it becomes, as we get not elevated railways, immortality, and hot pants, but you know, bread lines and germ warfare and doublespeak and all of these things. So, into this situation of retrenchment and cultural recidivism and the working out of modern values, which are materialist values, comes then the beginning of the postmodern era. I prefer a different term, which I call compressionism. the compressionist era, which follows the modern era. And its theme is the reemergence of the presence of the spirit, and its major cultural exhibit, or the major cultural force driving it, is the discovery of relativism with regard to consciousness, which does not only mean psychedelic drugs and hallucinogenic plants per se. It also means media. It also means literary expectation, reorientation of the senses through design, urban planning, the entire spectrum of effects which feeds consciousness back into itself is enunciating this theme of the emergent spirit. And it is not necessarily a welcome theme, because all institutions attain a certain momentum toward the preservation of their own vested interests. And science and the handmaiden of science, which is modern technocratic government, have created a number of cultural institutions that have a friction with the reemergence of the spirit. First and foremost is the notion of the public. The public is this weird idea that was generated in the wake of the printing press, that there were vast numbers of people who could be treated atomistically. They didn't have to be thought of as individuals. They could be thought of as various classes, masses of people to be manipulated. And if you could sell the public on the idea of democracy, which is another one of these atomistic notions. The notion of democracy is that for us all to get together and have it work, we have to assume that we're all alike. See? So we each have a vote, and then you may be tall, you may be short, you may be rich, you may be poor, you may be black, you may be white, but that doesn't matter. We'll give everybody this charge, one vote, and then we'll see how these populations work themselves out. What they don't tell you is that at the same time that you build this definition of the citizen, you also build the institutions which subvert the citizen. So the citizen is not free to act out and express the wishes of the citizen. The citizen is a consumer of ideological models that are sold to the citizen through agencies of mass propaganda. So there's this peculiar playing off of one against the other. In the meantime, what has also been happening is the institutions of language, which previously were pretty much left to develop on their own, and that was the situation well into the 19th century. Through the power of the printing press, the evolution of language also became something under the control of these institutions, and they very quickly have replaced whatever reality may have been impinging into the lives of the citizens with concepts. Concepts replace reality. You come into the world with a blank slate, and everything is what William James called a blooming, buzzing confusion. Well, then one by one, you isolate phenomena in this confusion and you name it. Once a sector of reality has been named, it stays still. It ceases to behave the way it would behave for itself. It begins to behave syntactically because it has been changed into a linguistic object. When things behave syntactically, they are either subjects or objects or the syntactical machinery which relates these two together. In that case, materialism, dualism, projection of authenticity beyond the self are all reinforced. So these are the factors which have impeded the spirit Into this comes the psychedelic experience. It has a tremendous force to revivify the spirit, particularly because it is not an ideology. It is not something someone figured out. It is an experience. And this is important to bear in mind. It horrifies me, I'm sure you've heard me say it, to think of someone going from birth to the grave without ever coming tangential to the psychedelic experience. It's like going from the birth to the grave without ever discovering sex. It means that you died as a pre-adolescent. You know, you never really came into your birthright. And we have been infantilized by our cultural institutions to accept the notion of ourselves as citizens consuming these regurgitated scientific models, which are then hashed through by Madison Avenue and then handed down to us by the organs of mass culture. And this is supposed to be what we anchor our lives on. It's no wonder that drug abuse, child abuse, self-abuse is rampant in this society, because it all has been taken away from us. You may read 1984 and think, well, thank God it isn't that bad yet. Well, the only difference between us and 1984 is we dress better. So I think that little gatherings like this, and I feel like this is definitely a family gathering, this meeting was sold out before there was any promo other than Roy's show and a small mailing we did. So you are people who have passed through a very narrow filter. You stay up late. You listen to KPFK, and you tolerate Terrence McKenna, so you are either thrice blessed or thrice cursed. I don't know which it is. But anyway, it feels to me like a family gathering. It feels to me like we are figuring this out, and there aren't that many of us, I think. But what we understand as a group, or what I imagine that we understand, is that there is this twilight of reductionism. There is this end of the old model. And yet we're not ready to proclaim the twilight of reductionism to simultaneously be the funeral of reason. You see, there are a lot of people, a much larger group than we represent, who are prepared to bury reason along with reductionism. And I think reason may have been caught in bed with reductionism, but it may have been set up. It's the take that I have on it. And is, as they used to say in Watergate, linked but not tainted. So, I am a very... some people even, someone said I was I was accused of being narrow-minded the other night. Because I come to this very honestly through the sciences, through trying to really find out what was going on and not just accept everything that came down the pike. I mean, I will believe anything if there's evidence, if it's self-consistent, if the case is well made. I mean, I think that the first thing the truth will be is a pleasure to hear, you know, and not some turgid and tormented thing where you have to go to 6 meetings and not talk to anybody who doesn't believe it and all of this sort of thing. So I think it's important as what I call the archaic revival gets rolling. It is important for us to clarify where we are coming from. When we were simply the lunatic fringe of the lunatic fringe, it hardly mattered. But responsibility will devolve on us to say what we mean and to have a position which is not only convincing to the converted, but convincing to the skeptics. That's who I'm after, you know, because I think that a great instance of cultural blindness is what we're confronted with on the issue of psychedelics. Psychedelics are to the science of psychology what the telescope was to astronomy in Galileo's time. And we are in a situation of increasing global pressure on our species, increasing outbreaks of neurosis, unhappiness, psychic epidemics, and we are leaving our best tools behind because of fairly preposterous cultural prohibitions. Cultural prohibitions which deny us our best weapons for overcoming the situation that we are in. And this is really an intolerable situation because the fate, nothing less than the fate of the human species, probably hangs in the balance. We cannot afford the luxury of an unconscious. We cannot afford stupidity, closed-mindedness, racism, sexism, consumer materialism, selfishness, an absence of globalism. These things are not necessary for us, for our moral edification, so that we can feel like well-bred ladies and gentlemen. These things are necessary for us so that we don't destroy ourselves. And the fact that this message is so slow coming out is a strong argument for activism on the part of anybody who thinks they have even the faintest glimmer of what is going on. You know, the future will not wait. I see the most crypto-fascist and intransigent of institutions slowly waking up to fairly basic facts, such as that a nuclear war is probably a bad investment. You know, so that even as Neanderthal a type as President Pinocchio is willing, isn't that a cruel thing for me to say? is waking up to the fact that it just don't pay. But, you know, we have a lot of problems. It isn't going to be the millennium, even if we achieve a massive cutback in strategic weapons. There's still going to be propaganda, sexism, starvation, inability to correctly manage resources. These things will plague us unto the last syllable of recorded time, unless we begin to undergo this kind of intellectual cohesion, the compression of our intent, the recognition of our group mindedness as a feeling, as a will that can act in the historical context. And to my mind, the psychedelics have always existed in the plants to promote precisely this. There were not language-using, tool-making tribes of human beings in the absence of hallucinogenic plants. The hallucinogenic plants create the context for integrated organizational activity. This has been going on for at least 15, 20,000 years. The problem is that through a series of factors, which we needn't go into in depth here, but factors which impinged on European civilization particularly, civilizations were able to evolve outside of the noetic input from Gaia, outside of the biological radio that envelops the planet and inputs into balanced tribal societies with functioning shamanic institutions. In Europe, somehow the chain was broken. The link back to the elder gods and goddesses and to the biological organization of human society before history was lost. And this curious kind of ungoverned intellectual development occurred, ungoverned in the literal sense of a machine which slips from the control of its governor. And in that situation, materialism, which is an insupportable philosophy, actually, if you have an openness, a sensitivity, any kind of cultivated feminine response to nature, it is utterly impossible. Recall that the point of view of Cartesian materialism pushed Descartes to actually claiming in public debate that animals were machines. He said they feel nothing. The apparent display of pain is simply something which we project onto them, because we alone have a soul. And Descartes, you see, had himself not gone over completely to materialism. He believed there was a human soul, but it came tangential at only one point to the human body. Somewhere in the pineal gland, there was a switch, and the soul was running things like a telephone switchboard operator from there. Well, very shortly after Descartes, his followers just said, well, we don't need this. This soul concept was just a thing to stay on the right side of the church, and we don't need it, and they cut it loose. And, well, once you cut that loose, then you have all kinds of permission. You have permission to rape and exploit nature, permission which had already been reinforced for Western man by the New Testament, but now raised to the nth degree by the assumption that nature is utterly without soul. And this philosophy persisted well into the 1950s. The essence of Jean-Paul Sartre's existentialism can be summed up in the statement, nature is mute. That was Sartre's position on nature. How many people thinking themselves existentialists and hanging out in coffee houses actually ever worked through what the consequences of the existential point of view was? Nature is not mute. You really have to have worked yourself into a weird place to believe that, you know. In fact, nature is entirely something else. Nature is communication, because nature is psyche. This is what we haven't understood. We have somehow talked ourselves into the belief that into the natural world of Eden, God came and made man, and from man, woman, and that men and women are of so ontologically a different level than the rest of nature that no conclusion about us can be drawn from an examination of nature. Nothing could, it's impossible for me to understand how this idea persists and has such momentum in the 20th century, where hierarchy theory has very, very clearly explicated the notion of the linkage of higher order systems to subsystems that are physically more simple. So you see, really what we have is a kind of fractal universe. In fact, it's not greatly different from the alchemical view of the 16th century, where people said, as above, so below. The microcosm is a reflection of the macrocosm. What this is really saying is that at the level of a planet, you get a certain level of organization and spectrum of peripheral effects. The same thing, such as self-reflection, self-regulation, intent, goal projection, steering toward perceived goals. You get the same kind of thing on the level of a society, can be a beehive or a herd of antelope or whatever, and you get it in the human individual and the human society. So really what is to be seen is that we are the cutting edge of becoming. We are not a thing apart. We are a unique level of a multi-leveled organism. And we have been called forth out of nature, by nature, for a purpose. And what is our task as individuals, I think, is to discover what that purpose is, and then to align ourselves with it in a way which allows the plan, whatever it is, to most smoothly unfold. Well, what it seems to be is a progressive invocation of spirit, the theme with which I began the evening, that through language, through abstraction, through magical invocation, the formulation of religions, the projection of art, the field phenomena, the phenomena which are diffuse in space and time and not easily located, are forcing or intruding their way into three-dimensional space and time. If you were an extraterrestrial in a starship in orbit around this planet, what you would see looking down is a gene swarm. The species that seem to us to be animal forms, extremely stable in time, are actually highly permeable membranes over millennia and tens of millennia, with genes crossing over, moving around, and being basically obedient to the expression of some kind of teleological form. And it was the concern of 19th century biology to eliminate teleology, to eliminate purpose and directedness. But it's very hard to avoid the impression of some kind of attractor ahead of this planet, embedded in its history, and somehow channeling everything toward it, so that the progressive acceleration of human society, of information production, of communication, the proliferation of languages, natural and synthetic, all of these things are not something going on in the human domain and somehow sealed from the general state of nature, but are in fact part of the general state of nature. And the human experience, or the human animal, as the carrier of this catalytic process, this speeding up and accelerating a process on the surface of the planet, is not sealed from nature, but the leading edge of a process on this planet. Now, teleology was so antithetical to 19th century science because they were trying to pull away from the telos of medieval scholastic philosophy. They didn't want God, these 19th century English atheists, Darwin and Lyell and that crowd. However, we have come through the so-called death of God and the elimination of a theological raison d'etre for the universe. And now we're looking more at a telos which we would operationally define, rather than define it based on ancient revelation. which was the previous method was the older the book, the truer it must be, and the Bible is the oldest book, and therefore it must be true. This is what Mercier-Liard calls the nostalgia for paradise, paradigm of time. We are overcoming that. It can now be seen that there is, in fact, some kind of transcendental object. And it's best to try and describe it phenomenologically. We don't know what it is, but we do know that it's an enormous attractor of some sort. And we are in the field of attraction. And by we, I mean all life on the planet is being drawn into this nodal point. And it is possible to anticipate it through the psychedelic experience. Because apparently, the natural and the linguistic world are worlds which are organized along the principle of fractal curves. Fractal curves are recently discovered mathematical objects. Not all of them are recently discovered. Some were known as late as the late 19th century, but most have been discovered using computers in the last 10 or 15 years. And they are self-similar curves such that when you take a subset of one of these mathematical objects, it is found to have the whole pattern embedded in it. The Fourier transforms that describe holograms are these kind of things. Coastlines, mountain ranges, data of all sorts, when analyzed in a certain way, is found to be fractal. Apparently, the world is a kind of vast spiral fractal that is achieving greater and greater closure with itself. And we experience this density of closure and this compressionism as the spectrum of effects which we call human evolution, human history, emergence of high technology, the present moment, the rush toward apocalypse. The most intense moments that the universe has ever known are the next 15 seconds. And beyond that lies still more intense moments. Novelty as a kind of generalized paradigm of the compression of connectedness throughout the cosmos is accelerating moment by moment in the rocks, in the trees, in the stars, and in us. And so what we call history, which is not as modern, the modern theory of history is that it's what they call trendlessly fluctuating. That's their model of the world. You get order at the atomic level, order at the biological level, order, 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 and suddenly you reach human beings, trendlessly fluctuating. It's as though, you know, we were Brownian, affected by the Brownian movement of random particles, and yet we somehow, out of all this ordering, we're to believe that then emerges the trendless fluctuation of human history. Actually, this is nonsense. It's simply that there has never been a thoroughgoing theory of history. However, now we are ready for them, because these wave mechanical ideas, the notions of closure, Sheldrake's idea about the presence of the past, the way in which the past drives the present, all of these things lay us open for an understanding of the compression and densification of time. And this is what is experienced in the psychedelic experience. Really, you know, Whitehead said of Dove Gray that it haunts time like a ghost. Well, I think that the compression of the three-dimensional universe at the end of time haunts time like a ghost. It's the cosmic giggle. Here a messiah, there a shaman, there an ecstatic poet, and there the tiny ripple that is simply a congruent coincidence in the life of a single individual. Robert Anton Wilson called this the cosmic giggle. It's when something protrudes through the forward flowing momentum of rational casuistry and causes it to flow around it and eddy and churn, and then you see through for a moment and you say, well, what is it? There was a plottedness for a moment. There was the hand of the maker there, but now I don't see it anymore. That is the going behind the veil. That is the seeing into the structure of being that lies behind the conventionalized languages. Coincidence is so often reported as an accompanying phenomenon for the psychedelic experience, because really syntax is dissolved, and syntax is a filter for this sense of immanent connectedness. And when the syntax goes, the immanent connectedness flows in. Then it's a question of what you do with it. If it causes you to believe that you are going to save the world, then you haven't gotten the message right. That's inflation. And inflation is very bad. It drives up interest rates. So if you get that kind of a take on it, you are misusing it. Nevertheless, the most advanced yogic techniques that are known are the techniques of the so-called Anuttara Yoga Tantra, the tantric yogic techniques. And there, the prescription is, it says in Herbert Gunther's Treasures of the Tibetan Middle Way, you should think of your house as a resplendent palace. Think of your utensils as made of beaten gold, and think of yourself as having a body made of living mercury. What this is in Western psychological terms is an invitation to inflation. But if it is approached with the right analysis of mind, basically that there is nothing but Bodhi mind and there is no particularization in time and space, then there is no inflationary feedback into the ego. And this is the kind of opportunity that the psychedelic opens up. It is, I've said many times, quoting Plato, time is the moving image of eternity. Time is the moving image of eternity. What the shaman does is he or she leaves the mundane plane, and in Iliad's phrase, is able to trigger a rupture of plane. And the rupture of plane carries the shamanizing person into another dimension, literally another dimension. And in that other dimension, all of time and space is beheld, as James Joyce said, in a nutshell. And in the nutshell of time and space, everything is seen to be a part, and a aesthetically pleasing, integral, necessary part of the transcendental object. In fact, what this universe is a lower dimensional slice of that same transcendental object. Well, I guess what impels my career and what I really can't get over is that what I'm saying to you is true. You know? That, I mean, we sit here, we gather here, and even though we're talking about this extremely far out thing, still all the forms are in place. I'm here, you're there. Everybody sits on their ass. Nobody sits on their head. It all appears fairly mundane. How can it be that what we are talking about is the nearby presence of an impossibly alien dimension? Now, if that alien dimension had been reported back to us by a robot probe dropped into the methane oceans of Europa, we would be all hot to go there. to organize a $20 billion expedition and a 15-year plan and go out there and find out what is happening. The amazing thing is that, you know, each one of us in our own living room can be this Magellan, can penetrate into these dimensions. It really seems quite freaky to me. Freaky to me that such a thing is possible, and yet that we are such monkeys, or so culturally constrained, or so blind, that this is not what we're all talking about all the time. And by we all, I mean all 5 billion of us on this planet, because we appear to be being pushed down a featureless corridor toward a furnace. And yet, if you would notice, there are all these doors along the side of the so-called featureless corridor. And nobody seems to have cognized that you can just open these doors and walk through and short-circuit the inevitability of planetary disaster. Amazing. Amazing. Because we pride ourselves on our commitment that science allows us to look anywhere, inspect any possibility. Our models are not dictated to us by the church or by government or by industry, when in fact they are dictated to us by the church, government, industry, mammalian organization. And so we are no better off than all those benighted people in those previous ages, where we look back upon them and say, well, they must have been so limited by their worldview because they didn't know about quantum physics and ketamine and Michael Jackson and cable TV and all of these things. But the fact of the matter is that unless we push through culture to nature, we too are dupes. We too are somehow being sold a line. And yet nature is there outside of the cities. You know, you drive an hour and a half from where we're sitting and you're in the high desert. And it is demon-haunted Paleolithic space. It is, it holds the same promise for us as moderns that it held for the Luiseno Indians, who were initiated into it, into their shamanic institution before the conquest, before history. So nature is the final arbiter of cultural forms. This is what Taoism understood, and this is what I believe the psychedelic plant thing is pushing us toward. It was not immediately apparent that this was so, because as I said at the beginning of this talk, in the 60s, the psychedelics came out of the laboratory, and only the most scholarly of the trippers bothered to study the natural origins and the anthropological and ethnographic context in which these things were coming from, like the Eleusinian Mysteries or the Mexican Morning Glory Mysteries or the Wasson-discovered Mushroom Mysteries. But if we can somehow link a respect to nature, a sensitivity to Gaia, a valuing of ourselves, complete placing of our own feelings and our own perceptions in the forefront of trustworthy sources, and the psychedelics integrated into our lives, then there will be a tremendous cultural impact, a tremendous reorientation, because the message that nature is trying to give, the steering signal on the human species, comes through the accessing of this shamanic dimension outside of history. Revolutions are made by tiny percentages of the populations in which they are, in which those revolutions are wrought. The important thing is clarity, and connectedness and clear understanding of who one's antecedents are, what the source antecedents are, and what the target goal is. New Age is a pale label for what is going on. New Age sounds too much like New Nixon, New Reagan, New retreaded everything. What is happening is an archaic revival, a harking back to cultural models 10 to 25,000 years old, because the profane fall into history is actually ending. The way the fall into history ends is with the progeny of Adam, the human race, recovering the control of the human form, the control of the human soul, the ability to turn ourselves into whatever we wish to be. This comes through the union of imagination, through understanding, into nature, the invocation of the dream. This is what the Australian Aboriginal Society is talking about. This is what the dream time is. Finnegan's Wake says, up me ent, prospector, you warp your woof and spread your wings, sprout all your worth. This up me ent, this end of time, this birth into angelhood lies ahead of us, but it is really part of the archaic return to the paradisical mode before history. The psychedelic hallucinogens are the catalysts. The minds that they touch become the catalysts within the society in general. And from there, the fashions, the social forms, the kinds of conscientiousness, the innate decency that is called forth by the authenticity of the experience is what will transform us. I mean, in the same way that an affair can become a love affair if there is mutual authenticity of behavior rather than simply a kind of flirtation. In that same way, our affair with Gaia can be a love affair if we can summon to ourselves the vision to make it so. And it means really being aware of the vastness of the options, of the precipice that late 20th century historical human beings stand on. We are about to leave for the stars. This is what is happening on this planet. A species prepares to depart for the stars. To do that, energy has to be marshaled. The lessons of the long march out of the trees and to this moment have to be collated, sifted, refined, concentrated. That is the alchemical gold. The historical process is the story of a prodigal son, of a wandering and a return. The return is meaningless without the wandering. The wandering has no meaning unless its fruits are given birth after the return. And I think that the last 1,000 years has been the prodigal journey into matter. And it ends finally with modern pharmacology, modern ethnobotany, discovering in the jungles of the Amazon and the mountains of Mexico the body of Eros, Osiris, you know, fallen since the time of the flood, but awaiting the re-emergence of the cognizant human connection. That is what the archaic revival holds out. It's actually our salvation. I mean, I think I'm fairly hard-nosed. I don't see any hope for us. I don't see any hope for institutional transformation unless it is done with an awareness of the transcendental object. And the religions that we inherit from the past are so screwed up that the only way to validate and empower the transcendental object is by self-experience, by direct accessing. And people say, well, but can't it be done on the natch? No, it can't be done on the natch, generally speaking, because if it could be, it would have been done. I mean, there are plenty of elder societies on this planet who have the rap down, you know, but look at the kind of societies that they erect. I mean, horrifyingly dehumanized societies seem to be the breeding place of the most sublime religions there are. So, no, I think it has to be, there has to be a humbling. We have to bow our heads and abandon the dualism that we inherit out of our out of Christianity and science and the whole Judeo-Christian Islamic shtick. We have to realize that it requires a symbiotic partner. It's a hand-in-hand effort. And if we are willing to take the hand which nature offers in the strange form of the alien vegetation spirit from the stars that seems to infuse us on plant hallucinogens, then we will go forward into a bright new world. It's a partnership. It's a challenge. It's the only game in the planetary village. And I appreciate your letting me share with you my notion of it this evening. Thank you.
Terrence Kemp McKenna from 1987, Los Angeles, California. This is Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. It's about 15 minutes after the hour of 1 a.m. now on April Fool's Day, 2008. No fools out there listening to this program, that's for sure. So, to my good friend, my brother, Terrence, thank you, my friend. Okay, so it is time to say hello and then goodbye again for a minute. Let's play a piece of music here. The Tragically Hip. This is a song called Courage, appropriately. And, you know, Terrence had a tremendous amount of courage. One of the things that Terrence McKenna used to say was that nature loves courage. And the point was, you know, to follow your heart and to not be afraid to do the things that you felt were good, right, and true, regardless of what the culture or the society may have indicated, you know. And if you did indeed show courage, that nature would reward you, and the reward of nature for your courage is that she removes obstacles and presents doorways that open where you never would have expected them, and presents people and events in your life that allow you to continue. And Joseph Campbell, who is another one of my inspirations and just this, you know, amazing person. I should mention Joe because he had a birthday on the 26th of March, just a few days ago. And Joseph Campbell was born in 1904. He was a professor at Sarah Lawrence University for many, many years, and a writer and a philosopher of sorts, but his specialty was mythology and comparative mythology and comparative religion, and he was very well versed on the mythologies of many, many, many different peoples over many, many ages across this entire planet. And Joe used to talk about a similar concept of being helped by hidden hands. And he had his own way of saying what Terrence said, and of course he said it before Terrence, and Terrence had his way perhaps of saying what Joe said. Joseph Campbell, one of the things that he is most known for is a simple phrase that's this one: follow your bliss. Follow your bliss. Three words. And Joe argued, very convincingly actually, and in his own life and work, that if you follow your bliss, well, you know, you will have the same result as if you show courage in the way that Terrence described. Nature loves courage. They were saying the same thing. And Joe always said that, you know, if you did that, that you would be helped by hidden hands, and doors would open, doors of opportunity, where you least expected them, and you'd be helped by people who you, you know, perhaps would not have imagined being helped by. So, anyway, these are the same ideas, and the central motif is that you be who you are. You not be defined by the culture, you not be defined by the society, you not be defined by institution and convention. You be who you are. You follow your own path, and you do it with courage, you know, and you follow your bliss. The big difficulty, or one of the many challenges in a culture like ours, in a society like ours, a time like ours, is, well, how do you even find out what that is? You know, what really gives you bliss? You know, how do you find something that you're willing to be courageous in your pursuit of? You know, and the plant psychedelics are perhaps, well, not perhaps, are certainly one venue that this can be attempted and very often achieved. The business of shamanism that we've been talking a lot about lately, and I said this before, but the business of shamanism, the work of the shaman, be the shaman a male or a female, man or a woman, doesn't matter, child, is to help and to heal. The primary function of the shaman is to help and to heal and to make art. But the first business of anyone, certainly before a person becomes a shaman, they have to take care of their own business. You know, you cannot help others until you yourself are okay. And this is the fact of the matter. You know, it's about clarity and understanding of situations and this sort of thing. So if you're unclear and confused and giving advice, you know, I mean, with all the best of intentions, you know, the results are oftentimes, you know, not at all pleasant and sometimes catastrophic. What's the old saying? You know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, right? Well, the thing is, the first of intentions should be to take care of yourself. Heal yourself. Help yourself. Get yourself comfortable and safe and secure and honest, straight about what's really going on in your own life, you know, and the lives of those around you. And once you do that, you know, it's this concept of circles that I talk about all the time. You know, your first circle is you. And you square that circle. You get it squared away. You get it straight. You get your own business together. You don't worry about what's happening in the greater world because frankly, when you're confused and scared and insecure and saturated with propaganda, it's impossible to know. And so for all of us, the first challenge, I think, is to recognize where we're at as individuals, you know, and how we fit into this whole puzzle and what we can do about our position in it and how that might affect the greater picture. The circle first goes around you, as I say. And then it can be expanded outward, right? It happens from inside out, not from outside in. You're not going to solve the problems of the world by going to Washington and marching on President Bush and whoever else is, doing whatever the hell they do there, right? That's the diversion, right? One of the many. Not that what's going on in Washington doesn't need to be changed. It does, right? But the way to change it is not by marching on Washington. You know, the way to change it is by changing yourself. Right? The one thing that you actually have control of, yourself. Right? Make yourself into an extraordinary person. Make yourself into a person that nobody else can ignore. Not because of your brutality. Not because of your malice and your pornography. Make yourself extraordinary through good deed and revelation and honesty and truth and compassion and the way of the shaman. You know, it's available to everybody now. We talked about shamanic technique a couple of weeks ago. Well, you know, it's available to everybody now. You don't have to be a shaman. You don't have to save the world, but you can utilize the technique and help yourself and your family and your friends and your community and eventually maybe Washington. And it's important to recognize that the methodology, the reason, you know, it's amazing, this talk that we just heard from Terrence in 1987, 21 years ago. And it's hysterical because Terrence always talked about back then, 20 years ago, and further back, about how the psychedelics presented such a grand opportunity because it was immediate. You could get the benefit quickly. And he recognized more than 20 years ago that this was something that had to happen fast. We don't have time, you know, to mess around with things that are going to take, you know, decades or centuries to perfect. The plant psychedelics are so profound in their, well, in the experience of them that, you know, if the right people do it, it can bring about tremendous change very, very quickly. There's no question about that. You know, so you just got to hope that the right people are doing it. And that's one of the reasons why I do the show and talk about this stuff so often, is because there are some people out there who are the right people who should be doing it and who aren't. And so one of my charges, one of my responsibilities is to, you know, share this information as it has been shared with me, to try to get the arrow to its mark. And that's what this whole business is about, getting the arrow to its mark. You know, Terrence mentioned in the talk that we just heard the concept of teleology, and to this day, you know, teleology is a topic that is just, it's heretical in the halls of science. The idea that the universe actually has a purpose, the idea that history isn't just a random walk
trendlessly fluctuating? Teleology says that there's actually something else going on, that there are forces at work far beyond and far greater than the human monkey, and that there is a plan and a process that is in place and ongoing that will result in a conclusion of some sort, something that will result in a culmination, a finished product. And frankly, that's what I think evolution is. I think that evolution is a close-ended process in a way, and that it's actually something that we're in the middle of, or the tail end of, but that will come to a decisive and obvious conclusion. And this is the idea of teleology, you know, that the universe has a purpose, that we're, that history isn't just for nothing, and that you have to, what was it that Terence talked about right at the end of the piece that we heard, right? The prodigal journey, right? The prodigal journey is history. And the prodigal's return is meaningless, even senseless, without the leaving, without the wandering, you know? So this is what history is. It is a wandering. And it may appear to be trendlessly fluctuating. It may appear to be a random walk, a random wandering. But I think we're very shortly going to be shown that history is not a random wandering, that all of the bloody backsliding and all of the horrors and all of the difficulties that our species and all of the other species on this planet have been through was actually for something. It's actually going to, you know, result in something, like a birth, something new. It's never been here before. It's never been here before. Something different on an ontological basis that we can't even cognize. The human being is not the finished product. And it may be the clay. All of these things on this planet are clay. The planet is clay. You know, and there's been this ongoing, ceaseless process of molding and baking and breaking and melting and reforming and crystallizing and on and on and on. It is an alchemical process. The process of history is alchemy. And, you know, there is in alchemy these concepts of the negredo and the albedo. The negredo is the flotsam, the prima materia, the crap, the shit, the dark nothingness from which the brightening will occur. And the albedo is the whitening. And both of these terms are the negredo and the albedo. These are both Latin terms, you know, sort of bastardized Latin, I guess. But the point is made, and we see it in many different languages. But from the negredo comes the albedo. And the whitening cannot occur without the dark. And if we look at history as an alchemical process, well, then we're very close to the conclusion of that process, because the darkness is apparent. The negredo is required, and the requirement has been filled. Next comes the whitening. Next comes the albedo. And I think it's actually very, very exciting when you look at the world like that. You know, everything is about perspective and who we are and where we come from. And if you, my God, if you follow the Judeo-Christian Islamic shtick, as Terence put it, you know, we're fallen angels, broken beings, less than what we were sometime before. Well, it's a lot different if you look at yourself as a risen ape and still on the rise. All right, it's a good time for a break. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. I meant to play this for Terrence 30 minutes ago. Nature loves courage.
Come on.
All right, everybody, that's the Tragically Hip, and the song is called Courage. It's Mike Hagen. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM, about 2 o'clock yet, but about, 17 minutes or so before the hour of 2 a.m., now on the 1st of April. Happy April Fool's Day to all of you out there. May you not be fooled today. All right, I mentioned Joseph Campbell before the break there, and had a birthday on the 26th of March. So here's to you, my brother, my grandfather, Joseph. And Terrence, of course, Terrence McKenna, on the 3rd of April, this coming Thursday. It'll be 8 years since Terrence left us. And one other person of note that I want to mention before the end of the program is Rudolf Steiner. Rudolf Steiner passed away on the 30th of March in 1925. And Steiner was, of course, he was an author and a philosopher and a scientist and somebody who had a great interest in the heart. The reason that I got interested in Rudolf Steiner was because of his, meanderings and ideas about the human heart. It turns out that he had a whole lot more going on in his life and in his work than I knew at the time, and I've since become much more interested in him. But he was an amazing person and introduced the idea of Waldorf education. Was actually a schooling system that Rudolf Steiner pioneered. He was the founder of Anthroposophy, or Anthroposophy. I don't know how the hell to pronounce that after all these years, but had a great intuition and imagination when it came to medicine, health, agriculture, music, lots of things, and was sort of an inheritor of the epistemology of Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, who is, again, one of our favorites, or one of my favorites here on the program. So, anyway, Rudolf Steiner celebrates the anniversary of his death, actually, yesterday, 1925, in Switzerland. So, here's to you. Another one of our ancestors and someone who we certainly should remember and recognize their contribution. Rudolf Steiner, aho. All right. Oh, I don't know. What else should we talk about here? I'm looking in the chat room right now. We got Ian and Marbles and Sushi and Steve talking about the Fields of Elysian and the UFOs and the flying saucer. Terrence McKenna, this is a great quote from Terrence that Ian puts up, and I'll talk about this for a minute after I read it, but he just says, quote, "The tool is the flying saucer, or the soul, exteriorized in three-dimensional space. The body can become an internalized holographic object embedded in a solid-state hyperdimensional matrix that is eternal, so that we each wander through a true Elysium." That's a quote from Terrence from I don't know when, but this was one of the ideas that Terrence had with regard to this concept of teleology. In other words, okay, if history has a purpose, if the universe has a purpose, if our existence and the existence of the world and all of those who have come before us has a purpose, well, what is the purpose, right? Well, good question. Everybody speculates. I mean, it's impossible to answer that question. It's hard enough to ask it. But one of the speculations that that Terrence had thought about was the idea that the soul is real. We talked about René Descartes in the earlier presentation from Terrence, and the fact that Descartes himself believed that there was still a human soul. Well, Terrence had this notion that the soul could become visible, material, externalized, and the body could become internalized, sort of the flip-flop of what we have now. Right now we have the body external, and the soul, who knows where it is, but I guess internal is as good a metaphor as any for it. The ability of a person to make that exchange, make that flip-flop, would be the paradigm-ending and paradigm-beginning event, you know, that ended history and began the next phase of life on this planet. And I'm not even sure it would be human. Who's to say what the final result will be? So, anyway, the idea of the UFO as the soul externalized is just a metaphor for anything. In other words, once the soul is externalized, well, then you could present yourself in any fashion that you so desired. So the saucer might be one that you would choose, you know, a trans-dimensional, superluminal, you know, an indestructible vehicle controlled by you, your mind. So the soul externalized could be this, that, or anything else. And at that point, you know, I mean, I guess it's time to end the conversation. Because, you know, the world as we know it ceases to exist and is replaced by something that we cannot imagine. It's just beyond, it's, you know, it's like the concept of God, right? All of these religions, all of these spiritual adventures and practices are all trying to convey the image of God. But it's something that is beyond image, beyond words, beyond form. Dhammarupa, as they say in the Indian tradition, you know, beyond names and forms. And it's simply a groping to try to find out what that ultimate mystery is really about. Maybe the goal of history, maybe the purpose of a teleological universe is to finally solve that mystery, to finally know God. Maybe the whole adventure of history has been a process of proving to ourselves as rational creatures, as thinking beings, that there actually is a creative force, an entity that is behind this whole business. You know, we are products of nature. Everything that we know is natural, including all the stuff that we think is not natural, computers and atom smashers and whatever else. Those may be created by human hands and human technology or whatever, but they are still natural. We are natural. We come from nature. Everything that we do, therefore, is natural and comes from nature. So the big deal is that the entity that created this whole thing, if you want to go there, you know, is not from nature. You know, try to put your brain around that one. In other words, that's why it's beyond names and forms. That's why God is not cognizable. It's because it's the entity that created nature and began this process that we're embedded in. But it is not of that same process. So maybe that's what the process is about. The becoming aware of and the eventual recognition, understanding, appreciation, and validation of a creative force, an entity, a God, something that is responsible, involved, and interested in what's happening here, and may eventually just tap us on the shoulder and say, hey, here I am. the psychedelics, the mushroom in particular, for me, give a very, very strong intimation that something like this is happening. And, you know, I don't claim to know what it is, but something is happening. And it is not at all what the great, great, great majority of people on this planet assume. And I think it's going to be a surprise for everybody. And I'm looking forward to it. It's Mike Hagan. You've been listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. It's been a pleasure talking with you all tonight. Terrence McKenna, here's to you, my brother, Rudolf Steiner, Joseph Campbell, all my friends out there, all my family, all my spirit guides, all my teachers, all my angels, all my ancestors, all of those who have come before us, and all of those who follow. For you and all of our children, I carry my chinupa for you, and I play this song.